Om Shanti. So there's one thing apart from breathing that we are constantly engaged in. And what is that? What is that? Thinking. You know? If you look at your mind at any point in the day, you'll find it thinking about something of the present, of the future, mostly of the past and the future, very little in the present. And each of those thoughts that the mind creates has, because thought is energy, it impacts everything around us and it impacts our own mind and bodies as well. So this session's topic is the effect of thoughts on health, and for which I'd invite Brother Balabhai to please come over on stage and talk to us about the effects of thoughts on health, on both the mind and the body. Brother Bala. And I'll request sisters to present a bouquet of flowers to Brother Bala and welcome him on behalf of all of us. Balabhai is actually the host, but for this morning, he's our speaker. So, very, very warm welcome to you. And I'd invite Sister Vijayalakshmi to introduce Balabhai to us.
So it's nice to be with all of you for yet another session. Actually, he is Balakishore, and as we fondly call him as Bala, he's always been referred to as Balabhai. Here is the introduction about this brother. Bala is a professionally certified coach as accredited by the International Coach Federation, and he is a member of the sports body for training coaches in the South India region. He has delivered impactful talks in several IT firms and institutes on various topics scaling through health, medicine, spirituality, education, etc. And for more than 10 years in India and throughout the globe, he has been with the Brahma Kumaris practicing this meditation since 1993. And he is also a member of the youth wing, the SPARC, which we call it as the Spiritual Applications Research Center. These are part of Rajyoga Education and Research Foundation, which is a sister concern of the Brahma Kumaris. And he is also one of the regional coordinators of the Brahma Kumaris global IT team for the South Indian region. And he was one of the 12 IT professionals chosen from all over India for advanced management program for young Indian IT managers in 2001 by the British government as a part of their Chevening Scholarship program. So it's our privilege to have such a senior intellectual and a youth in front of us. And he is now serving as the senior vice president in social networking and loyalty marketing with the United Online Software Development Private Limited. So now let us hear from Brother Balakishore. Shanti.
Thank you, Vijayalakshmi ma'am. Good morning and welcome once again for yet another interesting session. And if I am too fast, feel free to stop me. If you have any questions in between, feel free to stop me. I am not one of those speakers who, if stopped, you know, just get stuck there. So you don't have to worry about asking questions in between. And so today, I'm going to share a few things. The main theme of the next 90 minutes or so, what we are going to do is this. Human body is biologically endowed with all the necessary infrastructure to help us grow mentally and spiritually. It has all the infrastructure. What is required? What is required to grow? Even before you make the effort, what is required? Even before the will, what is required? You all have that. That's why you are here. It's very simple. Very good. Somebody said that. Yeah, desire. Rest everything comes later. I should want to grow. Very important. We all think of growing, but we should want to grow. And when there is that deep desire, when there is that passion, things start changing, and human body itself has all the necessary infrastructure to help that growth. And today I'm also going to share how does mind impact body, what is the science behind it, and how do I utilize this power that I carry within myself. So we'll talk about the processes, the techniques, or the mechanisms by which this mind impacts different parts of the body, and how can we use the power of our mind using this technique of visualization. Most of you who have attended today morning session at 4 o'clock, Ranjana Ben was mentioning something very interesting. She was saying, now I will speak, you listen, and at the same time visualize so that you can experience. Correct? That's exactly the sequence that she used. Now, how does visualization lead to experience? We will understand that. And how we can harness its power that's latent in each one of us, we'll explore that in a little more detail. And yes, the reason why all of us are here, the art of meditation. So we will also discuss in detail the art of meditation. So that any lingering questions or doubts any one of you has about why should I meditate, what did you do going to Brahma Kumaris, you will have a whole bunch of answers after today's session to tell them. Okay, game? Let's begin. So, you saw the video, just the 4-minute clip, who came a little early. It's about the placebo effect. Placebo means a dummy pill. And a classic example is, how many of you, when you were young, when you went to the doctor, when you fell ill, your parents took you to the doctor, as soon as you sat in front of the doctor, you started feeling better. Can you raise your hands? You didn't take any pill. You didn't say anything. He just greeted you, sat in front of him, and then you started feeling better. And that's the classic placebo effect. It happens because you believe that you are in front of an authority who has the power to alleviate your pain. That belief makes your brain to start generating feel-good chemicals called endorphins. And that release makes you relaxed. I'll share a few more examples. They did this experiment at Harvard Medical School. So they wanted to see if doctor's behavior, does it have any impact on patient's recovery. So they asked a surgeon. He was supposed to perform a few surgeries for a few people. So they divided the people into two groups. For the first group of people, what the surgeon did was, a day before the surgery, he went to the patient, he met them, sat beside them, put his hand around them and said, I am so and so. This is what I will be doing to you. And these are the number of hours we will be spending in operating room. This is the time it would take for you to recover. Don't worry, everything will be okay. Just relax. This is what he did for first group of patients. For the second group of patients, he, same surgeon, same hospital, and the same reason for the surgery. So the second group of people, he went there a day before the surgery. He stood at the entrance of the room. So there, hi, hello, I am surgeon so-and-so, and tomorrow I'll see you in the operating theater. That's it. And then he left. And then they did the surgery. And after the surgery, they kept track of how many painkillers were consumed by both sets of people and how many days they had to spend recovering in the hospital. What do you think happened? First group consumed 50% less painkillers. And they were relieved from the hospital 30% earlier. If the second group stayed for 10 days in the hospital, the first group was there only for 7 days. And they consumed 50% less painkillers. As all you know, the less painkillers you take, that means you are experiencing less pain and you are recovering faster. just with that one small change. You saw in that clip another experiment which they did at MIT. What they did was they picked up these students who were having very splitting headache just before exams, like most of us, or all of us, I should say. And then they divided them into two groups, 50 each. For the first group, they said, you know, this is a new pill that has come out, and each pill costs $10. For 7 days, take this pill, come back and tell us how do you feel. For the second group of 50 people, similar, same problem, headache, called them and said, this is a new pill, and it is subsidized by the government, so we are going to give it to you for 10 cents. $10, 10 cents, 100 times less. And then they sent them off for a week, came back after a week, asked them, what do you think they have noticed? In the first group, 40 people, they said they recovered from the headache. In the second group, hardly 18 people said that. And the twist is all of them got a placebo. It was just a sugar pill. And this behavior, even all of us see that, where cost is inexplicably wedded to the quality in our belief. That's why if you go to a doctor and say you're having fever and he says, no, it's okay, it's normal one, seasonal, just take a Crocin. And you go to another doctor, he prescribes a whole bunch of medicines and then tests and then, you know, makes you poorer by a few thousand rupees and then gives you a antibiotic which is about 150 rupees a tablet. Whom do you think is good? And in which case will you recover faster in general? The second or the first? And when you buy something expensive, even a simple thing like a jerkin, and your friend buys another one, but he just doesn't have that logo of Tommy Hilfiger, and he says he bought it exactly from the same place, you cannot make out any difference, but still you say, no, I feel better if I wear this because I spent more. And cancer, to a large extent in the last 25 to 30 years, whatever research has been done in that area, now we know very clearly there is a very strong mental component, emotional component associated with most of the cancer patients. And there's a doctor called Bernie S. Siegel in US who for the last 40 years he has been doing research in this area where he tries to help his cancer patients understand if emotionally there are some blocks inside which caused this cancer to arise in that particular part of the body. And when they change their emotional style, when they change their lifestyle over an extended period of time, sometimes 6 months, one year, 2 years, the cancer disappears without a trace. And because doctors don't understand, the regular medical fraternity does not understand, they call them a spontaneous remission, but there's nothing spontaneous about it. You work through yourself, you change your attitude, you change your emotional style, you change your lifestyle, what you eat, especially how you think, and then the tumor starts reducing in size. If you are alive after cancer and your cancer is removed completely because of your lifestyle change, you are not a good subject for medicine because you are not supposed to be alive. Just for your information, there are hundreds of thousands of people all over the world who had this cancer and got completely recovered. We don't get to hear about them because medicine is not so much interested in those cases. And there was this guy, live example, where this guy was in early 40s. He walked into Bernie's office, you know, complaining of chest pain. They did some tests and then found out that the cancer was in early stages. Then during the course of conversation, this Dr. Bernie figured out that this guy was running his own business and he was very stressful and he was the classic type A personality, as you must have heard, very driven, wanted to achieve. So he put the things in front of him. He said, it's your business, your stress, your thinking that is causing you this cancer, I think. So what is it that you really enjoy doing? He said, I thoroughly enjoy doing, staying in a home outside the city in suburbs, you know, buying my own house, spending time with family, and then doing carpentry. He said, anyway, you have very little time. Why don't you do that? So he went back, sold his business, bought a nice home outside the city, called all his family and started practicing carpentry. After 6 months, he comes back and then does a check. There's no trace of cancer. Because he was doing something that he found meaningful. When that meaning returned to whatever he was doing and he started enjoying and there was no longer any stress, the cancer disappeared. And interestingly, that fellow, he came back to the doctor and said, I lost my business, now I'm cured of cancer, give me my business back. And those cancer patients who were willing to challenge the prognosis, who were willing to challenge the doctor and then say, yes, I want to live and I am going to change my lifestyle, he has called them, Dr. Burney has called them as exceptional cancer patients, and he started this group called ECAP. If you search on net, you will get quite a lot of material on this topic. And he's also written a couple of books called Love, Medicine and Miracles and Peace, Love and Healing. Classics in the field of cancer and how mind impacts the health. Now, if you thought that only pills could do the trick, even surgery, to a certain extent, is a placebo. Don't get scared. And I'm actually going to show you a practical example that was done. Let's watch the video. I'm not even going to explain. You will see the doctor who has performed those surgeries and what is the result.
The idea was to treat people in great pain. Volunteers with severe knee arthritis were gathered from around the state and divided into groups. Two groups would have a surgical procedure. The third would be given a placebo, fake surgery. They'd have a general anesthetic, be opened up, but wouldn't have any real procedure. They would merely think they had. I had to meet the surgeon.
It's very important for the patients not to know which treatment that they have. And they're always trying to look for clues. You know, they're always trying to get you to tell them. And the best way to avoid that, of course, is to not know as a doctor until the last minute which treatment they're going to have.
Each patient would receive a general anesthetic, but only two groups would have an actual procedure. Not even the surgical staff knew who was in each group until they were in the theater.
I would open the envelope in the room and I would read it, but I wouldn't announce it out loud. And then I would show it to the nurses who were working with me, and I would show it to the anesthesiologist, and nobody would ever say which of the three treatments was revealed in the envelope. We had a very elaborate ruse, if you will. I would play a videotape on the TV of a real surgery. And while I was watching the TV, I would ask for instruments and pass things back and forth and carry on conversation as if it was what I would really have done if what was happening on the TV screen was actually going on during that surgery. So we would have water splashing, we would have instruments clanking, and we would do this for the same amount of time that the actual surgery on the videotape took place, so that a patient and their family couldn't watch the clock and say, oh, we were only in the operating room for 10 minutes, so it must have been a pretend surgery.
All this acting felt a bit weird to a doctor trained in standard surgical procedures.
In the big picture, always in the back of my mind, I was thinking, good gosh, here's a patient who we're pretending to do surgery on. We're not really doing surgery. And, you know, I'm a physician and a healer after all. And is this kind of really, you know, the right thing to do? Or what have I gotten myself into?
It took 2 years for the study to be completed. Finally, it was time for Dr. Mosley to hear the truth from the patients themselves.
I would say, if you think that the surgery helped your knee, I want you to give me a thumbs up. If you think the surgery didn't help your knee, I want you to give me a thumbs down. And if you're not sure or you're kind of neutral, just hold your hand flat.
The verdict? Success. For every group, fake or genuine. Sham surgery had worked. The patients who had it were astonished.
The response ranged from, you've got to be kidding me, I can't believe it, bewilderment, there must be a mistake, because they all felt so strongly that something had happened to change what was going on inside their knee.
During your training, what were you taught about the placebo effect?
Nothing. I had no clue. I went from being a skeptic to a believer. I realized that we were really on to something. There are clearly cases where we do surgeries and it's as much or more the patient's feeling about the surgery that influences the result as the actual surgery itself.
Dr. Mosley had seen patients get better purely because of what was in their minds. The pain had gone. It seemed too good to be true, and it did all happen 7 years ago. I wanted to see one of the patients who'd been in great pain before having Dr. Mosley's surgery. I wanted to know whether the placebo effect could still hold.
When I first had that pain, when I first, before that, I couldn't do a lot of things I did, like going fishing or playing basketball or going dancing. And after that, I was able to do that. He could. Woo. We could go dancing. He took me dancing, and he could dance all night.
Can you describe what the pain was like before the operation?
Terrible, awful. I didn't think that it could be any worse.
It's emotional. Why is it because you were in so much pain before?
Yes.
And what would you say it was that really cured you? Was it Dr. Mosley, or was it you and your mind?
That is kind of an intriguing question, you know, because I got to credit Dr. Mosley for doing what he did. But it was my mind that cured the problem.
I knew that Dr. Mosley's patients had been cured by the sham operation, but I wasn't expecting it to have changed his life. I mean, he couldn't talk about the pain that he'd experienced without crying.
Dr. Bruce Mosley continued this experiment, and he did this on 180 patients. Over the course of next 3 years, after his first experiment, and then he went on to publish a landmark article in British Medical Journal. If anyone of you is interested in reading that paper, you can drop me an email. You can drop an email. Any material that you would want to have access to, which we think we can share, you can make a note, sit@brahmakumaris.com, the same email ID. You can share with us what is it that you want, and then we'll see if we can share. We will definitely send that stuff to you. So he published a paper, and the same pattern repeated even on 180 people. And you heard something interesting where the presenter was asking him, were you taught about placebo effect when you were studying? He said no. Even to this day, medical curriculum does not acknowledge the role of mind on your body. Body is treated more as a machine. Some part is of a problem, so treat it, fix it, and then it will start running. So I was asking one of my cousins who just completed her medicine, I was asking her, did she learn anything about placebo effect? Did her professor teach her anything? She said, we only learned about the definition of placebo effect for 3 lines. And when I asked my professor, he said, I can skip that. And there are a lot of examples like this, but in the view of time, limited time that we have, I will move on to the next section to explain, to share with you, how does mind impact body? What's going on behind the scenes where all of us know that? Just before exams, how many of you enjoyed gulab jamun? Just before exams. 2, 3, 4, very few out of 250 or so. What is the reason why we don't seem to enjoy anything? Anxiety. and you will see that how that works. And this is the latest branch which started just 30 years ago, which is called as psychoneuroimmunology. How your mind impacts your body through your brain. Psychoneuroimmunology. Immunology is your ability. Immunity is your ability to fight diseases. So how these three are interlinked. So this is the science that explores the relationship between emotions, how you feel, nervous system, and your immune system. And it's concerned with bringing out the links between our states of mind and our states of health. So in this next 2.5 days that you're going to do, what you're going to do here is you can understand why you are feeling the way you are feeling because of what's happening inside your mind and your body. You think, you feel, your brain responds by sending signals to your nervous system, which in turn, you see the bidirectional arrow here, that means both of them influence each other. So brain through nervous system influences both immune system and your endocrine system. And interestingly, this loop works for both good chemicals that are released, painkillers, endorphins that are released inside the body when you are relaxed, and steroids or cortisol kind of stress hormones that are released when you are anxious and stressful. So this loop works for both the cases. Let me go into a little more detail and explain to you how this process works. Whenever you sense any kind of stress, whether it is physical, psychological, or environmental, that perception of threat or stress is received as a signal by hypothalamus. It's a very small peanut-shaped gland inside your brain. It receives that signal and it releases a hormone called CRH, cortisol-releasing hormone. Just don't worry about the complicated names. Understand that the hypothalamus sends a signal to a pituitary gland, which in 10th standard biology we studied is the master gland inside our body, which controls our entire endocrine system. And pituitary gland sends yet another hormone as a signal to your adrenaline glands, which sit on top of your kidneys. And receiving that signal, adrenaline glands, they release what we call as cortisol, the stress hormone. And as soon as cortisol is released, a bunch of changes start happening inside the body, where your blood pressure increases, your heart rate increases, your perspiration increases, and blood is pushed to your skeletal muscles so that you can run away from it. And at that point of time, you will not think, what is it that I'm going to have for dinner or lunch? Because the body itself, because of its inbuilt mechanism, has pulled your attention away from the digestive system. And this is the inbuilt mechanism our bodies and brains have. But if that stressor happens to be your boss, you want to run away. That is what your body is telling you. That's how the body is responding. But can you do that? Constantly, if that situation is not handled, these little stressors pile up and a lot more of these toxins start building up inside the body. And as you must have heard, stress is one of the major causes for many of the lifestyle diseases that we face today. And the loop is like this. This is how it happens. You think, and then the body responds. And a similar loop exists even for the positive stuff. When you relax, the same nervous system will start releasing endorphins, feel-good chemicals, and your respiratory rate goes down. Your heart rate slows down and you start feeling better. And that's what we call as relaxation response. When you relax, your brain is sending to all cells of your body an all okay signal. Absolutely fine. You're in Mount Abu in meditation hall, enjoying sessions. Don't worry, just relax. And once you enter the office, once you start feeling stressful, any situation, that stress makes your brain send a not okay signal. And the beauty is, this body is a fascinating instrument. It is the most complicated chemical factory you can ever imagine. It can produce both elixirs, that is amrit, nectar, the life-giving nectar, and also life-taking poisons. And the switch is in my hands. Which way I flip is in my hands. If there is one message which you are going to take away in these 2.5 days, it is this, that you are in control of your state of mind. You can flip the switch. Even though environment, your son, mother-in-law, father-in-law, mother, boss, kids, they may appear to be causing stress, you still have control. And remember in the beginning what I said, the human body is biologically endowed with all the necessary infrastructure for us to bless with the growth if we desire, if we want to. Good. That's another interesting book which was written by a scientist called Candice Pert. She was able to identify that what is the mechanism by which mind communicates to the body, what kind of chemicals are released by the brain in order to help the body understand what you're feeling and accordingly respond. And that's what she called them as molecules of emotion. So whenever you feel, whether positive or negative, the cells inside the body seems to sense them, you know, through these molecules of emotion, and then accordingly either generate stress hormones or generate feel-good chemicals. Now, this is how it happens. Positive emotions make the brain release what we call as neuropeptides. Neuropeptides, each emotion has the corresponding set of neuropeptides where they carry some information to different parts of the body. So we call them as molecules of information also. And if it is negative emotion, you have negative neuropeptides released. And I'm trying to simplify as much as possible, removing all the complexity. So just try to understand the essence behind it. And positive neuropeptides make your body release, or your brain release, endorphins. The negative neuropeptides make your brain and your body release steroids or adrenaline. And these feel-good chemicals release healing energy, and the steroids release harmful energy. And healing energy results in health, harmful energy results in disease. And it all begins here. And why should I be positive when there is so much negativity, Bala? You know, Shivani Ben says that, Brahma Kumaris say that, Ravi Shankar says that, be peaceful, how can I? He yelled at me, and I have to yell beyond that for me to feel good. Otherwise, I can't sleep. I must show this fellow what I am. You know what? That's the way the world is, Bala. Come on, give me a break. Good. Understood. But if you want to grow, if you want to live healthy, we'll explore a lot more in the next few minutes. Now the science is coming back and saying there are a lot of positive results for yourself, for your own body, if you think positive. Let me show you how some of the positive emotions impact our health. When you are compassionate towards the other person, when you generate that empathy, that love, that understanding towards the other person, there is something called vagal nerve, and its behavior is what we call as the vagal tone. Compassion strengthens your vagal tone. When this vagal nerve, which innervates different parts of the body, it starts here behind the brain and then it permeates even to your heart. When the vagal tone is less, and it is consistently less over a long period of time, that has been found one of the most important reasons for heart attacks. And when you are compassionate, that compassion, that act of compassion seems to strengthen that vagal tone. And this vagal nerve is the primary component of parasympathetic nervous system. We have two things built into our body. One is to excite us whenever we want to, That is what we call a sympathetic nervous system. The other one is to calm us down once the situation is over. That coming back to calm is what we call a parasympathetic nervous system. And vagal nerve plays a very important role. So when you are compassionate, whether the other person is receiving your compassion or not, who is benefiting? Who is benefiting? I am benefiting. My own heart is getting strengthened. And in Brahmakumaris, I mean, if you are interested, every third Sunday from 6:30 to 7:30, wherever you are there in the world, 6:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., for 1 hour, we do this compassionate meditation where we spread the vibrations of peace, love, and power to the souls of the world. And if you are interested in learning a lot more about this, you can visit Center for Compassion and Altruistic Care at Stanford. Stanford University runs this center. When you forgive someone, your own stress levels get reduced. Forgiving is not forgetting. Forgiving is not forgetting. When somebody caused any harm to you, they come in front of you, your ability to not to allow that bad experience to influence you in the present is what we call as forgiveness. That bad person does not necessarily suddenly start become good. You don't have to go hug and kiss him or her. No, that's not forgiveness. Forgiveness is this understanding that event in the past because of this person should not impact my present. And you let go of that negative experience from interfering. That letting go is what we call as forgiveness. That's where most people misunderstand forgiveness. It is not that you will forget the bad experience. When you see that, if it is a really bad experience, if the traumatic experience has been generated by the other person, you will remember. The point is not that. The point is, are you allowing that remembrance to impact your present? When you don't allow that, that's what we call as forgiveness. Charity and immune system. This research was conducted at Duke University. What they found was, those people who do at least one act of charity per week, one act of charity per week, have their cardiovascular strength increased and their immune system becomes better. That one act of charity can even be, you know, taking a destitute woman who is trying to cross the road or an old person trying to cross the road. You get down from your car, make time, allow that person across the road. How do you feel? Feel good? That's what is there in giving. And now science is saying, by giving, you strengthen yourself. This is another interesting research done by Professor Sean Acker in Harvard. What he wanted to do was, he divided, based on his questionnaire, professionals into two categories in an organization. He called them as work isolators and work altruists. Work isolator is the one who is selfish, who does not want to share, who does not mingle with others. And work altruist is the one who is willing to share, who is willing to take and give. And he found out if work isolators are promoted 7% of the time, work altruists are promoted 40% of the time. That's 6 times more. So when you share, when you are altruistic, at whatever level, it even contributes to your own professional growth. And you can see that. If you are the manager, you have an opportunity. All things are equal between two people. One of them is willing to help the team. The other one is interested selfishly in his or her own growth. Whom will you promote? No brainer. When you thank, when you are grateful for what all you get, instead of worrying about what you don't have and didn't get, it has been found, research after research, that a simple act of writing a gratitude journal, even twice a week, what is it that you are thankful for makes your life happier and healthier? Shall we do that exercise? You all have your notebooks? Write 5 things as of now that you are thankful for. Go ahead. while you write, try to feel it, whether it is because of a person or any skill or because of the situation that you are in, try to feel that while you write. Grateful for? You feel better? I can see all smiles. What you just did is start writing your gratitude journal. What you just started is what we call a gratitude journal. And in simple terms, we say, start counting your blessings. And now science is coming back and saying, when you start counting your blessings, you will not only feel happy, you will also feel healthy. Now, this is yet another interesting finding from the science. You can learn to be happy and compassionate with practice. From whatever time I can recall, Bala, I am the most grumpiest fellow on earth. I don't know how to be happy. I am like this only. No, you don't have to be like this only. If you want to, you can change. You can be happy. You can be compassionate because it's a skill. It's not a trait. So how do we harness this power of mind? Can I consciously tap into it? Now, before I move forward, any questions? Can you all stand up, please? Raise your hands up, front, up, front, up, up, front. Sit down, thank you. One of the ways in which your body can influence your mind. Now it will take a little longer if you want to fall asleep. So how do we utilize this power of mind? How do we harness? Is it available on demand? One of the ways we can do is through this process called visualization. Now I want to just do one small exercise. Okay? Visualize yourself in your home, opening the refrigerator, picking up your favorite sweet or juice or whatever, eating it or sipping it, and then coming back here. Close your eyes, do that, and come back. You did that? You went there? Opened your refrigerator? Picked it up? But you're still here. What you just did is what we call as visualization. Create a picture in your mind. And this works because any form follows an idea. You first think about it and then you do it. And another fascinating aspect is your brain cannot distinguish between you imagining something and you actually doing it. Fascinating characteristic. That's why even though you are here, when I said you come back, you go and come back, nobody objected. and you got that feeling as if you were there at home. The reason is, when you imagined, your brain generated exactly the same response as if you were there. When I move my arm, there are a bunch of nerves inside the brain that get activated. When I visualize moving my arm, the same bunch of nerves get activated. That's what it's called, the difference. That's how visualization helps. And how do we tap into this power? How do we utilize this characteristic of the brain? Because if you see here, this is what we call as the higher parts of the brain, and these are lower parts of the brain. This is your thinking brain, and this part of it is what is connected to the different autonomous systems inside your body, whether it is blood pressure, heart rate, feeling hunger, all that. And it has been known, lower brain areas implement what higher brain areas decide. So when you empower your thinking brain, when you become emotionally stronger, the body also starts responding. And visualization can even physically change your brain. When you are cynical, you are the one who always sees the dark side of things. You know what? It's going to be really wonderful at Mount Abu. Yeah. Let's go and see. I've been to many places like that. You know, there's some really wonderful movie. All movies are like that. Big deal. They charge you, please you. If you are like that, now science is saying, for some reason, brain doesn't like cynicism. The neurons inside your brain, they actually atrophy and they die if you're too cynical for too long. And I'm going to show you yet another small clip of a scientist called Pascal Lyon, who does research in this area of visualization. And the ability of the brain to change is what we call as plasticity, neuroplasticity.
That the brain can change because we can learn new things. And that's true. But if plasticity is an intrinsic property of the brain, it's neither good nor bad. It's just the way it is.
Alvaro Pasqualiani is elegant, charismatic, warm, mellifluous, expressive. And whenever he does something, he radiates a very serious sense of playfulness.
Just going to start with a relatively low intensity so that you have a sense of what it feels like. I've done this enough that I have a sense of what your motor cortex is going to be. TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation. And it is a way to stimulate, to apply currents to specific parts of the brain, but without having to cut open the skin, crack open the bone.
Oh, wow.
And
that was my bicep.
Sort of the bicep movement, right? That's sort of more your little finger. You know, one of the things that we've learned from TMS is that we can use it to map the brain. We can use it to understand how brain activity relates to behavior. We can also use it to modify the brain. We can use it, depending on the parameters of stimulation, to actually increase activity in a part of the brain or to suppress activity in a part of the brain. So I'm just going to target your language area. That will give you a little feel of what it is like when people are trying to speak and can't because of a stroke in that area. Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's getting tough. I was still slurring my speech.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I became interested in is the question of how do the maps change when you simply think of things? When you don't do anything other than thinking. We took normal subjects and we set them in front of a piano and asked them to learn to do a five-finger movement exercise. They just had to go from thumb to little finger, back to thumb, back to little finger at a given rate. And we found that over these 5 days of practice, the part of the brain that controls finger flexions got larger and larger and larger. But we had another group of subjects who simply sat in front of the piano and imagined themselves moving. And we made sure that they did not move but simply mentally rehearsed the actions. What we found in them is that the brain changed in exactly the same way as in those that actually physically practice. So the idea is that just thinking will change your brain. And what that ultimately means is that one needs to be careful with what one thinks.
This beautiful experiment complements the work of Nobel Prize-winning psychiatrist Eric Kandel, who showed that thinking actually turns on genes inside neurons to form new connections between brain cells. And this idea is further complemented by brain scans, which show that psychoanalytic, cognitive, and other psychotherapies also change the brain structure through the use of thought alone.
I think we're now learning that, in fact, the brain is changing all the time. And so the challenge is to learn enough about it so that you can guide the changes.
Thank you. So now you saw what science is saying, that thinking has the capability to even physically change the structure of the brain. And what are some of this capacity of visualization? When used in a directive way, visualization helps in healing. That is, when you direct your attention to that part of the body which is not working and visualize that it is going to work, it starts improving, whether it is in pain control or in any other area. Used in a reflective way, visualization helps in accessing inner wisdom. You'll get a lot more opportunities during these 2.5 days to sit back, relax, and then think about whatever you have been hearing as a part of these sessions, where you can sit and churn, sit and reflect about those to increase your own inner understanding. And neuroscientists have also discovered that visualization establishes neural pathways inside the brain which act as blueprint to be followed in the actual performance. That is, if you're one of those who is scared of this kind of public speaking, if you visualize speaking to the people like this, the corresponding networks of a public speaking will get formed inside your brain so that when you actually do it, you won't feel that bad. And visualization has been found to be one of the best ways to influence our subconscious mind. That which is not accessible to our conscious mind, we can influence that using visualization. And even in health, these are all the diseases or the areas in which scientists have used visualization and to see how it positively impacts. There's this doctor called Carl Simonton who uses visualization to help his cancer patients along with medicine to get over it, and his success rate is 2.5 times more than those doctors who use only medicines. Fascinating. And if you are interested in learning a lot more about visualization, there is a website called Academy for Guided Imagery. Academy for Guided Imagery, if you go to the research section, you will see a whole bunch of studies where this visualization as a technique has been applied to treat or help alleviate the pain of that particular disease. Academy for Guided Imagery. Because visualization, scientific name is, we call it as guided imagery. Okay. Should I continue? Okay. A little louder? Thank you. So that brings us to this interesting concept of meditation. What happened? Yes, brother. Yes and no. The details I will tell you for both after the session. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. There is a possibility. The reason why I said yes is it is possible. And if any one of you is interested in learning about what we call as ESP, extrasensory perception, and the research that has been done, search for this guy called Harold Sherman. H-A-R-O-L-D-S-H-E-R-M-A-N, Harold Sherman. He's done a lot of work in this area, sitting with scientists, written some books, you can read that. The reason why I said no is there are certain specific characteristics that are required by the transmitter and the receiver. If those characteristics are not satisfied, if the receiver is, his or her own world, anxious, is not receptive, whatever vibrations you send will not be received. So you need to satisfy a certain criteria for it to work. That's the reason why I said yes and no. Okay? Good. So we'll talk about meditation and what meditation does and why is meditation useful. One of the latest areas of research where you might be surprised by looking at the benefits that I'm going to list, is it really true? Trust me, it is true. If you are interested, I can give you enough research material. Now, can you read this? Now read this. What's the difference between these two? And space is empty. And that empty space, what did it add? Very good. It added clarity. And that clarity reduced the amount of effort that you put in doing exactly the same thing, reading. I didn't change a letter. I just added some space and some punctuation. You are reading. The content is exactly the same, but the addition of space has increased that clarity, which in turn reduced the amount of effort and the stress you feel while doing it. For you, ladies and gentlemen, that's meditation. As simple as that. So now, yes, sir. Yeah. You don't do anything what you are doing in meditation. You do something else. You create those little spaces all through the day where you can connect with your own self, as Sister Mohini was talking about. And what Sister Shivani is going to talk at length today, both with your own self and with the Supreme and with the people around you, so that you get that clarity. Why I am doing what I am doing the way I am doing. Once you get that clarity, it reduces the amount of effort that you put in what you're doing and you start enjoying it. Then work does no longer becomes a burden. You start enjoying it. That's how adding that space in your daily life a few times improves the quality of life. That's how that space is related to meditation. And what is the meaning of this word meditation? It comes from a Latin word called meditatio, which means to think, to contemplate, to ponder. That's the meaning of meditation. And meditation is also attention training. You can train yourself. Meditation helps you to improve attention. How does it happen? We will explore in the next few minutes. Well, fantastic. What you're seeing now, the tape that gets played here in Brahmakumaris, we call it as traffic control. That's the signal to create the space. So is it okay? Shall we sit down in meditation for a minute? And when you sit down, just visualize yourself as a point of light and you are spreading these rays of peace and health to every cell of your body. Just feel that. permission. Meditation is also self-introspection, where you talk to yourself with love. You're not critical. You remind yourself of all the positive qualities that you are endowed with. And that process of reminding is what we call as meditation. Just like that, if you sit down, either you get a waste thought or a negative thought. But a conscious generation of positive, powerful, uplifting and elevated thoughts, a lot of which you have already started hearing, which you will continue to hear in these 2.5 days, is what we call as meditation. It is dwelling upon the nature of divine. In tomorrow's session in Raja Yoga, Shivani Ban is going to talk about in little more detail. Meditation is understanding one's own spiritual identity. So, let's first taste it and then discuss about what all happened during this experience or what all actually happens and what are its benefits. So now I invite Chayaban to walk us through this experience of meditation. You can set aside all your paraphernalia, pens, papers, both your feet firmly on the ground, sit straight with your back supported. Don't fold your hands, leave them free, have them rested on your legs.
Om Shanti. Let us move away from the world of words and sound and create a space within us where we can experience the deep silence. So I request all of you to be seated in a relaxed posture. Please don't hold anything in your hand. Keep it aside, your books or pen. Please sit straight. As I switch off from the outside world of noise and sound, I find my body is completely relaxed. Relax your legs, thighs, your stomach, shoulders, your neck. Now your whole body is relaxed. Observe each organ of your body, each cell of your body is so relaxed, bringing your awareness to the middle of your forehead, where the life energy resides. I find myself being different from this body. Sentient energy radiating peace, relaxing my mind. As I start my journey into my inner world, I observe there is a pool of peace within me. Deep within me, there is peace. As I touch upon this peace, vibrations of peace emit from me. I observe this state of mind as I start to observe this. there is a space created in my inner world. I store this experience of peace, this space, so that I retrieve it when necessary. Peace. As you observe your mind, it's completely still and relaxed. As I go further, deeper into my inner world, there is just stillness within me. Observe the stillness and feel how relaxing it is, how soothing it is. Deeply, this healing many of the wounds in my mind. As I start to observe this healing process, I find many of the things hurting me, bringing me pain, discomfort, I have let go. I am totally free now. I let go it forever. Observe your state of mind now. You are just being without any bondage. Experience the freedom within. Experience the healing within. Now observe my mind and body completely tuned to this healing. I find myself fresh, new, more energetic. Let us sustain this energy. Let us sustain this freshness and newness throughout the day. Slowly, as you open your eyes, observe there is a fresh surrounding, fresh atmosphere, fresh vibrations in and around you. Just intake this freshness deeply as possible. I promise to myself to sustain this throughout the day.
Thank you, Shaman. It's good. So, what was happening inside the brain when we were doing this meditation? When we are normal awake state, when you are at desk, non-stressed, the brain generates something called beta waves. When you are relaxed, calm, and then attending these kind of sessions, brain generates alpha waves, 9 to 13. When you are deeply relaxed and meditation, which we just came out of, brain generates theta waves. And when we get a deep dreamless sleep, brain generates delta waves. Now, why are these important? The slower the rhythm of these waves, the more the body rejuvenates or recovers. That's why sometimes when you are listening or you are too tired, you just close your eyes for a few minutes, you sleep, you take a short break, and then you wake up, you feel really fresh. And then you have to say, I hope you are not like that now. You must be fresh, but I hope you didn't get into that state yet. Because the brain got into this state. That's where that freshness comes. Sometimes you have slept all through the night, 8 hours, 9 hours, and you still feel groggy. You still don't feel comfortable because the brain hasn't got into that state. Meditation helps us to consciously get into these two states while being awake. What we call as conscious relaxation, which is one of the best ways to send healing vibrations to the body and to the mind. You're conscious, yet relaxed. That's what meditation helps us. They are actually very few. So if what the science talks about, you know, in an hour you generate about 60,000 thoughts. In a minute, I guess, yeah. 60,000 thoughts or a few hundred, few tens of thousands. And here you might be having a few hundreds. Or if you start developing your focus, you can even reduce it to a trickle. You know, through constant practice, today's Amrit Vela, if you were attending, Ranjana Ban was talking about making your mind like a screen and observe your thoughts coming as actors. And the beauty is, the mere act of observing your thoughts reduces the speed. And inside, when you meditate, different parts of brain undergo different changes. This part of the brain, the thinking brain, which is responsible for us being human, when you are meditating, this goes offline. That is, the number of thoughts that keep getting generated constantly, that number consciously reduces. And that part of the brain, which works as brain sentry, that is, trying to look around the environment and try to sense, you know, is there any harm that is happening to me? That activity also reduces. That means your levels of anxiety, they get reduced when you meditate, because that part of the brain that makes you feel anxious, if the activity is higher in that part of the brain, you feel anxious. Meditation reduces the activity in that part of the brain. That means you start feeling less anxious. So that's how meditation also helps in reducing not only anxiety and even your blood pressure. And sometimes as you sit and meditate, you feel you have transcended this body and you are one with the universe. At times, even for a few minutes, you will get that sense in deep meditation. There's no magic to it. What happens is that part of the brain, what we call as thalamus, the parietal lobe here, this part of the brain is the one that gives us that sense of self. That is, my hand is completed in this space, and the chair begins or the next person begins. So that boundary that we have gets generated because of that part of the brain. When the activity in that part of the brain reduces when you do meditation, you feel liberated. That is, these boundaries that got created, the construct, that dissolves. So whatever experiences we go through in meditation, it's no longer that, you know, I don't know what's happening to me. Now we know what exactly is going on inside the brain and why you feel the way you feel during meditation. And what are some of the benefits? Even a few minutes of meditation every day, how do they benefit? First, it helps you to stay in the now. Research after research shows most of our sorrow is generated because either we regret the past or worry about the future. If consciously we can learn to stay in the moment, in the present, and keep telling your mind, this is not the time for me to think about the report that I have to write next week. Today, now, I am here, let me listen. Gently bring it back. Keep doing it. This process actually not only strengthens your brain, but it also helps improve the quality of your life. It reduces self-centered me thoughts. The other end of these too many self-centered me thoughts is what we call as depression. And the number of depression cases in the world is increasing at an alarming rate because of this. One of the important reasons. First, you feel helpless, then you feel hopeless. Prolonged hopelessness results in depression. So watch out. Whenever you feel helpless, try to check. Are you trying to control something that is beyond your control? Even if you just sit back and then check the reason for your sorrow, any situation that is causing you trouble or anxiety at this point of time, it can only be one reason. You're trying to control or influence something that is beyond your control. Easier said than done, but with practice, we can overcome that. It can strengthen the brain circuits responsible for concentration and generating empathy. When brain, it is processing information, okay? I'll give you an example. How many of you were noticing the sound of the fan? Now that I said, this is the beauty of attention. Attention brings to focus whatever stimulus that brain is processing. You're hearing, but not listening, because you're not paying attention. The waves of sound from the fan are coming, but you're focusing on what I am speaking, hopefully. So that's why you're not listening to that sound. And that ability to focus, to increase that concentration, it comes from a bunch of brain circuits, which gets strengthened through meditation. So when somebody says meditation increases concentration, you know the reason now. Something very fascinating. It can alter your gene expression. A gene is like a switch. You can switch it on or switch it off. When you are relaxed, those genes that are responsible for generating stressful hormones, they get switched off. You can keep them off. The switch is in your hands, and meditation can alter gene expression. Another fascinating stuff. It increases gray matter. That is, brain contains neurons. When you meditate over a long period of time, these neurons get strengthened. This cortical matter inside the brain, it becomes thicker. Thicker cortical matter means you live longer with a healthier brain. And it strengthens your immune system because meditation leads to relaxation response, and relaxation response in turn empowers the body's immune system. And if you want to live longer, meditation is one of the sure shot ways. And how does meditation do it? What is the science behind it? you must be knowing that each cell has chromosomes, correct? And on top of chromosomes, you have genes. Each chromosome, at the end of it, it has a cap, what we call as telomere. What meditation does is it helps protect that telomere and increase its length, which directly contributes to increasing the biological age of this body. That means your age is actually going to increase, so you're going to live longer. So that's how meditation also helps in increasing our lifespan. So what is the summary that brings us to the end of our session today? Awareness, thoughts, beliefs affect biological processes and hence health. You saw that. How belief impacts biology, you saw that in the case of the placebo effect that we just reviewed. Persistent negative emotions, whether it is anger, mistrust, jealousy, bitterness, they bring disease. Constant positive emotions, love, peace, faith, hope, happiness, trust, they bolster health, and you saw the mechanism behind it. Most important, as I was saying, I am both in charge, and I am not only responsible, but I am also responsible. I have the ability to respond to a situation and not just react to it. Health, like destiny, is a matter of choice. It's not a matter of chance. And I have the capability to create the kind of future I want. And meditation is good for health. And the reason why we spent 90 minutes is when the rational mind is silenced with logic, heart can run supreme. That's the reason we put this as the first session. Now I hope all your questions, all your doubts of why I should meditate, what is meditation doing to me, why is it good, why should I continue, I hope all those are answered. So now your heart can run supreme for the next few days and you can experience it. And some of the references I can send you. Drop an email at sit@brahmakumaris.com and I'll send some of the material if you're interested. Good, that's all I have for today and thank you. Om Shanti. Well, we have another 4 or 5 minutes, so if you have any questions, go ahead. Differences? So. Oh, this one? This one? Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Each one of us has 3 different kinds of ages and BKs have a 4th age added to it. All of us have physical age, the chronological age. You subtract your birth date with today's date. From today's date, you get your chronological age. Then there is biological age, the number of years where your body can live. And there is psychological age. You might be 60, but still have the enthu of 16. You might be 16 and lose all interest and behave as if you're 60. That's psychological age. All of us have all these 3 ages. The alaukik age for Brahma Kumaris is when you get this new knowledge or information that you are a soul and not this body. From the time you have understood it and practiced, your alaukik age starts. So that means here in Brahma Kumaris, there are some very interesting phrases we use. We say, for how long are you in Gyan? Gyan means knowledge. When is it that you learnt about these new concepts and from when you have started practicing it? You might be 50 years old and you might still say, I am 6 months old in Gyan. So that means your alaukik age is 6 months. Any more questions? Yes, sir.
Thanks for the information, Balaji, provided, talking about the brain level, how do the meditation goes about. If I talk about a typical IT scenario, today what happens is, you know, we have a lot of married couples, the people are running here and there, working on, you know, building upon their career, jobs and everything. What happens is that, you know, today we lack people whom we can speak to or talk to. Okay, if I talk about a particular, say, married life scenario, husband is working for the family, wife is also working, both are, you know, independent today and everything. People enjoy life, go for parties and everything. When we want to, you know, enjoy, we get a lot of people. But when we really want to talk to someone, say, heart-to-heart level, we hardly find anyone to talk to. Okay. I'll, you know, just cut down and come direct to the point. How do you, you know, correlate or maybe differentiate between heart-to-heart talks and meditation? If I say today, you know, I am depressed, I am stressed out, maybe because of, you know, financial situations, family scenarios, or a job. And if I talk to someone whom I can connect with or who can, you know, step in my shoes to understand, I feel much more better than when I meditate and talk to myself. People do, you know, find pleasure talking to oneself, sitting down, fixing their priorities. But when, you know, you do an heart-to-heart talks, okay, when you're able to relate to each other's life, that improves and maybe, you know, bring more positive results. So how, what's your view on that?
Yeah. There are three different ways in which we can talk to feel empowered in different scenarios. One is when in this kind of situation, talking to yourself becomes easier. That's one kind of conversation with love you can have. The second kind of conversation, when you want some clarity, when you want to decide a few things which you are not able to decide, when you want somebody to empathize with your condition, that's when having a conversation with another person is very, very useful. If you are depressed, then we don't suggest them meditation. Because meditation sometimes can actually increase depression. When you sit with yourself, depression means those same waste thoughts or negative thoughts or the me-centered thoughts keep repeating even more faster. In those situations, meditation is not helpful. At that point of time, having a conversation with some other person with whom you can bounce your ideas off is useful. There's a third kind of conversation, which you will be introduced to, Sister Shivani, if you're not already introduced to, is to have in Brahmakumaris what we call as ririhan, the heart-to-heart conversations. Hindi word is ririhan. You have that ririhan with your father.
One small query, you know, maybe a clarification or maybe, you know, lack of knowledge I have. You know, throughout the sessions or somewhere, you know, even through, you know, the experiences I had in the past, talking to people of, you know, Brahma Kumaris and all, there's, you know, always stress upon the power of meditation. Everywhere it is stressed upon, you know, you do meditate in the different intervals, like you just said that, you know, you find spaces in middle, do meditate on that. Why isn't there, you know, any stress upon, you know, when people fix their priorities in life, when they sit down once, talk to them oneself, fix their priorities, they're able to, you know, have a clear objective in life and move ahead. How does, you know, every time, you know, you sit down and meditate helps you?
Very simple. You keep recalling those priorities and fixing them so that you don't go off course. When you are driving, you sit and decide, yes, from Mount Abu, I have to reach Ahmedabad. That decision is important, necessary, but not sufficient. When you are winding down the path, that clarity that you should reach Ahmedabad will not help you to negotiate the twists and turns on the path. You need to be alert. You need to be awake. While you have this thought that I am reaching Ahmedabad, at the moment, whatever situation I am facing, I should be attentive to it. So these spaces bring back my attention to the present so that I can reach the goal in spite of all the twists and turns. That's why doing only once is not enough. That's why science also says, it again and again reinforces saying constant practice. Just do it once or twice, there is change. But then you go back to your old ways, that change gets nullified. Yes. Can you give the mic to her, Deepak?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Om Shanti Balabhai.
Yes.
My question is, generally while doing meditation, either I sleep.
Okay.
or else tears comes from the eyes.
Okay.
So, I mean, what is the difference? I mean, either I am in a very good sleep actually, and then I feel very fresh also.
Yeah.
So, and then another meditation means sometimes I find that a lot of crying and some light I see and tears comes from the eyes.
Yeah.
So,
you feel sometimes when you meditate, if physically or mentally you're exhausted, that space allows you to go to sleep. When mind does not have anything else to do, you sleep, which is fine. In the beginning days, if you fall asleep, don't worry about it, don't whack yourself. That's the part of the process. When that meditation, when you get that connection, you feel cathartic. The process of catharsis, when you feel that you are indeed not as bad as you thought you are, or you are indeed that beautiful, when you see that acknowledgement coming from the other side, whether it is from the light or God or whatever you call, or your own self, tears start coming down. You feel really good and refreshed because somebody has acknowledged your presence as you are, which is what each one of us yearns for. Whether in a relationship or with ourselves, we want people to respect us, accept us, and allow us to be ourselves. And light is the one, the expression that you have used, which does not have any expectations from us. So when we go into the presence of light, you feel that catharsis. Because you start experiencing that acceptance, which gives rise to the tears. So you're absolutely on the right track, sister. Don't worry about that. If you feel asleep, sleep. Yes, somebody raised their hand here.
Actually, I wanted to add to what you said when he asked that question. It's like basically the question is on lack of decision making capacity when he is talking about not fixing up the priorities and all. So when I came into Gnana or I did that 7 days course, and that's what when it was the time when I realized that our soul is so depleted of love, decision making capacity, wisdom, everything.
Yeah.
So that we find ourselves incapable of doing things on our own and getting dependent on people to ask for an advice or fixing up the priorities. So as we move on with the course, or when I was done with the course, I'm continuing with the meditation technique. I'm really thankful to Baba and really thankful to all the Brahma Kumaris over here that I'm able to regain that capacity of decision making, of gaining wisdom and lesser being dependent on people or situations around. So I will definitely recommend it to the guys sitting there. That do the 7 days meditation course. It will really help you to fix up all the priorities of your life and take important decisions of your life.
Very good. Thank you. And I want to make one small difference. Maybe I'll take just yet another minute. There's a difference between spiritual health and mental health. You need not be mentally weak in order to be spiritually weak. You can still be mentally strong. You know what is right and what is wrong, but still not have the capability, the internal power to follow the right path. That lack of that internal power to know what is right and still not be able to do it, to not still make a decision which is useful for yourself because you want to get along with the crowd, you are scared of what they think, those fears come from that lack of that spiritual strength. And that's what you learn as a part of Raja Yoga meditation, where you are introduced to yourself afresh. As simple as that. What you started realizing, sister, it was not that you're getting from somewhere else. You know, you're not buying it from somewhere else and stuffing inside. It's coming from inside. That's why we call this as a journey inside.
So for a person, for one day, so he may work 14 hours and he sleeps remaining 8 hours or 10 hours. So my question is that Brahma Kumaris are minds focusing on if you are 14 hours, how we can able to utilize the soul conscience. So my question is that how we can able to do in remaining 8 hours whenever sleep, in which way we can able to get a soul consciousness. So that is what my question. This is the one question.
Another very good question, which I will reserve for Sister Shivani because she is going to answer that much better.
Okay, one more. In Bhagavad Gita also.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Bhagavad Gita tells there is some layers in the second chapter or third chapter.
Yeah.
It is the senses, above mind, above intellectual, above
yeah.
soul and above super soul. These are the yeah. five layers they will also tell. So similarly, Shivani also told yesterday morning. So today you told that what is the mind thinks now. So I wanted to understand, I understand clearly that what is the senses as well as mind. So I want to, what is the way, that interaction between intellectual and mind. So what is the pathway to the intellectual as well as soul? How we can able to make a interaction between both them? Because I have more knowledge on senses as well as mind also. But I am very, I don't know more on the how we can able to interaction with the intellectual and mind. So this is what I wanted to know.
What I will do is, you catch me, I'm somewhere around in the 2.5 days. Go through the process. On 5th, as a part of valedictory session or just before that, you ask the same question to me. And then we'll have a conversation. Because that's precisely what we will be learning in next 2.5 days. If I answer elaborately, it will be like me talking about gulab jamun without giving gulab jamun to you. So first have gulab jamun and then we'll have a discussion about gulab jamun. Okay, brother? Thank you. Om Shanti.